Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It is Mavis and Zeref had a son named August 2nd, 2017. I'm Nick here with Chris. We're going to talk about manga.
What no one realizes is that we were in cahoots with Hiro to make it so that that exchange happened perfectly, that we could make an August joke.
It was quite fortuitous that we're having our discussion as we begin the month that he is named after. Especially because no one else is named after him on the entire series, so.
No.
But anyway, not like there's a shortage of options for it, you know.
May? May's an easy month. April? April's like a normal name, you know.
April's a normal name, yes. June, of course.
There's a Spooktober. Someone could be called Spooktober.
There have been people named January.
January Jones, very lovely lady.
Yeah. But, outside of that, like, February, March, July, September, October, November, December, you don't really see a lot of people named after those.
Nick, are you forgetting about the long-running band, the Decemberists?
I guess.
They did that one song, like, the hey, da 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 ba ba da 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 hey, da 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 Something. It's the Guitar Hero song. You know it when you hear it, Nick. I can't do everything for you, alright?
Sure I would, yeah. Me and my encyclopedic knowledge of Guitar Hero songs.
That's like your thing, isn't it?
I'm really good at Guitar Hero 3, but that's about it.
Yeah, that's true. Hey, Nick, I have a very quick story to tell you before we start talking about Fairy Tale.
Sure.
So,
We gotta keep our tangents a little bit shorter this time because we're starting late, but oh well.
Yeah. Just real quick though. So I had a customer in the store the other day, cause I'm part time at a grocery store. It was really late in the night. Just came by. He was like, hey, I need, hot chocolate. Don't know where it's at. So I guide him over to where hot chocolate is cause I'm a good employee. And I'm like, so, all right, there's hot chocolate. I'm out. Like this interaction's over. But he stops me and he holds out his hand. He's like, he wants to shake hands. And I'm like,
because you did your job.
Yeah. I can understand if I was a fireman and did my job, maybe a handshake would be okay. It was like, I showed you where hot chocolate is. But that's not it. So I'm like shaking his hand. I'm like, this is strange, but whatever. And as I'm shaking his hand, he's like, thank you for being a true American hero. And I'm like, not with any level of like a glib kind of attitude to it. Very legitimate that he considered me a true American for showing him where hot chocolate was.
Was the exact turn of phrase "true American hero"?
I don't think hero was involved in it, but it was
true American.
It was definitely very much expressing like you embody the spirit of an American right now. Like I'm like, sir, I showed you where hot chocolate is. I did not just come home from the war. All right, I think we're getting a little ahead of ourselves here.
Did he start talking about pickup trucks? If you're a true American like Chris Larios, the man who showed a customer where the coffee was in the grocery store, then you deserve to drive a Chevy.
It was Dennis Leary actually narrated my way home back to my car. He's like, look at this guy. 6 foot, all American, badass, walking back, got off at 10, clocking back in the next morning at 8. This is a real American. And the commercial plays 28 times before I got home, but yeah, no,
The automatic doors to the front of the store open up. You step through them, stop right there in the threshold, and go, we the people!
Yeah, I was like walking back home, and the fucking Jack Swagger theme song started playing.
Wow.
I could not comprehend what to, like, say in response, because I think what I did say was, like, have a good night, because I was like, what do I say? I was expecting almost like fireworks to start going off behind me or something. I'm like, I don't know what to say. This is so big of a compliment to be getting for this sort of action.
I will say, though, that I'll take a million weird but genuinely grateful people over the kinds that will just, like, expect you to weigh on them hand and foot and will be upset if you don't go above and beyond to fulfill the stupidest goddamn requests that they have.
Oh, so. Yeah. I mean, this is, oddly enough, not the first time I've had a weird interaction with a customer where they want me to shake their hand at the end of it. The other one was a bit more weird, though it made more sense, but that's a story for maybe another day. Because
I got a hug from a customer a few weeks ago, so. Oh, man. All right. So, we do have manga to talk about this week, Chris.
And yes, we do.
We have, it's a big occasion because, every single time that a series that we cover, comes to a close, we need a bit of time to reflect on it. Sometimes, you know, it's like Nisekoi and we don't need to take like a special episode to talk about it or anything like that. But for a series that, we cover every single week for years on end, have a lot of memorable moments, like, the frickin' Apocalypse Dragon is the, you know, showing up and destroying friendship with his breath weapon is one of, like, the moments of Weekly Manga Recap that we look back on. I think I named our fantasy football league that, like, the last year that we did it.
Yeah, the Apocalypse the Dragons. Apocalypse League. Yeah, when I made a guild in WoW, they were the Apocalypse Dragons.
A good name, you know?
It is.
And it's over now. Fairy Tail, is finished up last week. It's a stupid finale chapter. But that may not necessarily reflect how we feel about it as a whole, and we've had a time, we've had a week to digest and allow, I guess some genuine final thoughts to germinate, if you will.
Yes, this has been a long-running series, despite the fact Fairy Tail is sort of weird in that I feel like it hasn't been actually running that long, but it did run for basically like just under a decade. A very long-running series, and it was not fully...
I guess because it never felt like it was, you know, long. It never felt like it was bogged down in anything.
It moved very quickly, and I think a little bit of the part of it that makes it feel shorter is that there are definitely arcs in Fairy Tail that are forgettable. That, like,
oh, yeah.
I'm going to be bringing up a couple things during this that I'll be surprised if you can remember some of these things because I had forgotten.
I barely remember the Edelus arc, and that was one of the really important ones. So
yeah, there's a lot of points like that in there. So that plays a part into it, but this is going to be an interesting discussion because going into it, I'm not really sure which way I'm going to end up. Mm. I have had my thoughts on Fairy Tail swayed very heavily in each direction throughout this past week. We did our weekly manga recap, Livs, our bonus pod for last month.
Yes, we did.
And in the process of that, I found myself reading through some chapters of Fairy Tail and finding odd instances, like these certain individual chapters, which at the time I kind of looked at, I was like, this is actually a lot better than I thought. I'd kind of forgotten about some of these moments. I'm sure if you go back, you could hear it on the podcast when it came up, but like the chapter where Mira Jane has her fight against one of the demons, and it's all kind of regarding her ability of fully embracing the Satan soul and what that meant for her as a kid and her siblings. I was like, this is actually a really well done chapter. And there are moments like that. And I'm like, maybe I'm too hard on Fairy Tail. Then we actually did the weekly manga recap Livs. And I was like, man, we covered some really bad chapters. This is, maybe it's not. Then I started reading Fairy Tail for the beginning. And I was reminded how good Fairy Tail was at the start. And I was like, you know, maybe I am just too hard on it. And then I started thinking about other things as I read further along. And I was like, God, this is just awful. And it's really like a pong game in my head right now. And I'm not sure who's going to score the first point.
Yeah. I'm very different in my thoughts on it because quite simply, I came into Fairy Tail. We had our really big catch-up podcast discussion. We went on talking about Fairy Tail for quite a long time, if I remember correctly, when we did that a few years ago. And essentially what I said was, it's all stupid.
Yes.
It's fun. It's just really stupid. And I don't care when bad stuff happens because it's stupid.
Yes.
Covering it week to week, there were definitely some times where I got more frustrated. But in general, I was just kind of numb to everything that happened. Now, my experience with it, I mean, it's always going to be different because, like, I never had, like, time where I just kind of, like, knew about Fairy Tail, like, on my own. Part of it was painted by the fact that, I was influenced by you talking about it well before I bothered to pick it up and try to read it. But that being said, every single time that I read a chapter, I don't know, I will definitely give it this. It was a lot of fun reading it week to week because something always happened. Something stupid usually happened. It was always eventful. There was never a chapter that you could, at the same time, in a contradictory aspect, every single chapter was, very few of them ever felt really essential. but none of them felt like they were inconsequential. Because stuff would happen. There was never any part where it was just like, okay, let's just kind of catch our breath and talk for a little bit. And kind of just reiterate stuff that the audience already knows. Those were very few and far between. I think that we actually kind of sort of covered one of them in the Weekly Manga Recap Lives. It's the chapter where the Spring 12 come back, and there is a little moment at the end of reflection. It lasts about three pages before the next chapter just jumps back into, you know, the action and stuff. And that's just kind of the series was. It threw a lot of stuff at you very quickly, and so you could interpret it a couple of different ways. You could interpret it all as a bunch of noise, or you could just kind of enjoy the ride. And for the most part, I felt like I enjoyed the ride. It was all just really stupid, and I didn't really care if it was disappointing in the end.
That's understandable. I think there's definitely... I think I kind of recognize that, too. You, as you said, you made it yourself very clear when you first recapped Fairy Tail and we did that big catch-up. You were like, I think this is stupid, but I don't get angry.
Yeah.
And that's definitely been the opinion you sort of maintained throughout. I mean, I think you even had that in the final chapter where you're just like, I don't know why you guys are getting angry. It's always going to be stupid. Why are you expecting something more? And, like, I guess in a comparison way, that was a thought I kind of eventually got to with Bleach towards the end, which is why mm-hmm. you had definitely a more, like, passionate opinion on Bleach's ending than I did, where I was just like, I've just stopped caring. I've just learned that Bleach isn't going to do what I thought it did, so I'm just out. I'm out. Like, it's whatever. I'm a fucking asking knock LeVar Blue. This is wacky shit. There's a laser chicken over there. Woohoo! But in that, you know, in that inverse of this situation, I definitely have more, you know, strong opinions on Fairy Tail, if only because I did have a stronger feeling on the series in general. So there is going to be a little bit of a mixture of that. And I've been noting several times, I found myself in moments recapping my thoughts on Fairy Tail, and I get heated in the thoughts of, like, I get, in Atsu's own words, all fired up thinking about certain aspects of Fairy Tail, because
we live and learn from our mistakes.
Yeah. The thing that I keep catching on is whether or not I can make any peace with Fairy Tales and, I don't know if there's a better way to say this, I'm just not thinking of, but a degeneration into something more accessible and widely enjoyed by everybody. I don't want to use the word pandering, but to be honest, it's probably the best word when Fairy Tale became a more pandering sort of series that just wanted to kind of do what the fans would want out of, like, a perfect series or whatever.
It's definitely a much more appropriate word than it should be, I guess. It fits, the description fits too well, basically.
There's some sides of it that I think, honestly, throughout Fairy Tail's history of being recapped on this podcast, I've been too harsh on. I could recognize there are points where I probably am getting too angry on it or things like that. But then there are some points where I'm like, man, this really is infuriating shit. There's moments of Fairy Tail that are just dumb and really, really funny. Like, Sting just showing up to be like, I'm gonna beat Fairy Tail. And then he sees all these weakened members of Fairy Tails. He's like, I give up. Your friendship is just there. And they, you're just like, what was the point of this?
Sting and Rogue, just in general, everything revolving around them as important characters was weird and stupid. He will become the ultimate force of evil because Gray killed Froch. Why would Gray kill Froch? Well, the series doesn't really know that because when he sees Froch, he's just like, he's really cute.
Yeah. So. I mean, there was a moment where just like, oh my God, Gray was in that evil guild. Although he wasn't actually evil and in the guild, he was secretly, like, you know, infiltrating them. I wonder if it's going to happen when he sees Froch, like, just out of nowhere. He's like, I fucking hate this cat. Just icicle to bed. But there are some legitimately infuriating moments in Fairy Tail. And I will maintain that I think the Fighting Festival arc is just a complete clusterfuck. A conclusion that even regarding the, like, shamelessly garbage, you know, hands in the air celebration, that the whole Luxus conclusion just is a mess. Just poorly written and just really reeks of, like, everyone in Fairy Tail are friends. I've been trying to kind of rationalize where my two schools of thought are and where I kind of fit in. And I think I've found where I'm standing on this, but I want to note that in general, I think Fairy Tail, I've probably been too hard on in the past at points. And there are some very legitimately good points in Fairy Tail, not just exclusively at the beginning. There are some decent points along the way.
Sure. But
fuck, this series has pissed me off at times.
Even like, you know, in times that we've, you know, recapped, the series, like, there were some points that we did genuinely enjoy, like, Laxus had a really good fight with a wall, for example, not too long ago. Some of the, interaction with, Acnologia before he all of a sudden became a tragic character in the last three chapters, all of a sudden.
Like, the last eight pages of his fights.
You murdered my family! I just thought you were evil, okay. We're never going to actually explore this, but okay. But yeah, I definitely understand for... Especially because my perception of Fairy Tail was shaped by reading that first 350 chapters in one big chunk. And so I saw all the ups and downs on, just kind of all creamed together. And so I saw that, and I kind of had the, I guess, median mood established from all of that. As opposed to if you were experiencing a little bit more in real time, if, you know, you were a big fan of Rave Master and you followed up on, you know, Hero's next work, or if you heard about Fairy Tail from the early hype and you started reading it from that, then, yeah, I could definitely see how you would have this longer-running perception of it as a really promising series, and then you would get disappointed by it over time. And, you know, we are both, I guess, at roughly at the point now where it's like, eh, it was stupid, but it was fun sometimes. But I can definitely see how the different ways that we, the different paces that we experience the series really shaped the kind of reaction to that conclusion that we have about it. For me, it's just like, eh, whatever. And for you, it's a bit more of a disappointment.
Yeah, that's kind of what I have the issue with, because there's a difference, I think, in the series if it was as it was towards the end from all the way through. If it was always like Fairy Tail as we kind of have come to accept it as, especially at the end, where there are no consequences, and everybody's just goofy fan service fun, and everybody wins, and friendship's the only thing that matters. But that isn't actually the case with Fairy Tail. And I wanna speak to what Fairy Tail did really well, because the reason I ever got into Fairy Tail to begin with was because I legitimately enjoyed it when it started. Fairy Tail starts off, and it's a very different series from what it becomes. You know, fan service is not its focal point. Even though the first chapter involves Lucy almost getting sold into sex slavery, it's still actually not the same sort of, sexually charged series it is later on. You know, it's not constant upskirt shots and naked characters or things like that.
And there were busty characters in Cheesecake, but there was not a girl chained down to a prison cell with a goat licking her bare feet.
Yeah, or there just weren't upskirt shots directly, you know, or just things of that nature. But there were also better forms of writing, too. Like, there were actually legitimately well-told and interesting stories. One small one I had completely kind of forgotten about is a small mission where Lucy and Natsu have to go retrieve this book. And there's this sort of story going on that, you know, the people who asked them to get this book are like, just burn it. Lucy finds out it's this book written by a famous author of hers who supposedly had never written any others. And, you know, there was like, why was this book here? Why does this person want to destroy it? And it actually has this really interesting and well-told payoff of essentially this book written by a father who, you know, was forced to write this book for a very greedy, self-absorbed man. And he used his magic to essentially hide a very touching story to his son in it. And, huh. You know, that fits with what Fairy Tail... And I forgot that there's actually layers to it, because it's not just as simple as like, oh, hey, they find out the secret story. There's a tragedy in it, too, that they didn't find this book prior to the guy, you know, the father dying. The father actually killed himself out of sadness because he was ashamed at what he had written, and his son had lost a relationship with him, was just angry at his father for disappearing for years. But upon reading the book, the son gets to experience all the joys that his father had on these adventures. And it's this amazing two-page spread where when, like, Lucy shows how it's like, no, your father wasn't ashamed of this book and stopped writing because it's the worst book he ever written. It's because it was the best book he'd ever written. And you see all these different words shooting out into the air and magically changing into new words that are meant to detail all the various adventures that this guy had had. And you're like, wow, like, this is really well told. Like, this is an interesting kind of story. And that's kind of where some of my issues came with Fairy Tail, is that later on they don't do those sorts of interesting stories as much anymore. The plots are a lot more straightforward. I guess you could call it Marvel movie formulaic, where it's like, we have to stop this thing from happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all they really do. And it's frustrating, because there were really solid moments. Almost everything you could complain about with Fairy Tail, like the friendship speeches and things like that. There are fights early on in Fairy Tail where the idea of friendship being the motivator is an important part, but it's not actively the thing that helps them win. For example, when Natsu has his fight with Gajiel, his first big fight with him, well, I guess technically second, but when he had that big fight on inside the Phantom Lord mech robot guild thing, which just sounds weird to say, Natsu sees his guild destroyed before his eyes. It is a harrowing moment where you see all of the different members of Fairy Tail watching as the guild, the building they grew up in, have all these treasured memories with, is destroyed and crumbles before them. And Natsu,
this was the first of like five times it was destroyed.
Yeah,
so.
this is when it mattered. And Natsu is just furious at this, but he doesn't just beat Gajiel because he's like, my friends are sad and my friendship fuels me. No, he's still actively too weak to fight back. So it's about Lucy finding a way to actually get him some fire so he can recharge his energy so that then he can use this powerful new emotion to win the fight. And that's a much more interesting conclusion than some of the many we get later parts of Fairy Tail where characters just say, fucking friendship! Ah! And just like, that's how
right,
it
actual,
ends.
Actual teamwork necessary for it to work, as opposed to just everyone kind of goes, yay!
Yeah, or addressing that just, like, the emotion of friendship can be a powerful motivation, but they still need to actively find a way to defeat this thing that is a counter to their magic or whatever, you know?
It was a big thing that Natsu did, was that he had to basically eat Laxus's magic in order to beat him, like when he did, like, the lightning flame dragon or something like that.
Yeah, I believe he ate some of the lightning and, like, got lightning powers for a moment or something like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there were just kind of those sorts of twists at certain points, playing with expectations maybe more than twists, like, when they went to the island that was seemingly cursed with monsters, and it turned out, oh no, actually, you know, it's an entire civilization of monsters that live here. The curse was that they couldn't remember what their form was, and so they thought they were humans cursed to look like monsters.
Yes.
Just a little bit of a playing with expectation is really that kind of indication of a bit of a creative spark, I guess, that you could see if you kind of wasn't there towards the end. I can't really think of a very big twist. I think that the biggest twist was the fact that it was August who was Xerath and Mavis's son and not Licarde.
Oh, you mean a good twist? Because I can tell you tons of twists that didn't work.
Right.
I mean, like, in comparison to that moment you just mentioned, which was one that we had not necessarily clues to say, like, oh, wait, it's not actually them being demons or whatever. They're always demons. It just affected their memory of that. But that was a story that had still been ongoing, that there are these people suffering from this curse that they wanted to have lifted. Contrast that then to Wendy's Guild, who we never met.
Not real.
We hadn't met at all. Wendy just comes home and they're like, we're all ghosts. Goodbye. Feel sad.
Your family now. Bye.
Feel sad, Wendy. We're all dead. I'm like, I don't know any of you. This is why I get frustrated, because on one hand you have something that's a legitimately good, like, well-told story, and then on the other hand you have something that is just emotionally manipulative nonsense, and that frustrates me, because it all kind of plays into this dumbing down of Fairy Tail that came about over time. I'm going to get to it a little bit, because I put together a top 10 list regarding Urza And this plays into it. But there is, in my mind, a very distinct point when Fairy Tail makes the change from being a, what I thought was a sometimes stupid, but ultimately harmless and fun battle series to something that just was devoid of trying to do something interesting and just wanted to cater to what the fans would ultimately want out of it. And it's annoying because Fairy Tail early on has some of my favorite moments in manga. I love the moment when Fairy Tail first bursts into Phantom Lord's Guild Hall after they saw what Gajeel did to Levi and the rest of Shadow Gear. And they just smash through and they're like, we are Fairy Tail! And then later you have that moment when they're like trying to finish things up with Phantom Lord and it cuts over to that one forest bitch who just helps Fairy Tail out at times. She sees Mistgun and she's like, why aren't you helping them? Like, in such a big moment right now. And he's just like, bitch, and just like throws all these flags in the air. You're like, oh, that's so fucking dope. Those are great moments. I love those. I wish Fairy Tail had more of those. And, you know, reading those made me reconsider. Like, maybe Fairy Tail wasn't all bad. But then when I read some of the things that happened later, when you're like, oh, right, there were like three straight arcs that were all about Jalal. And you're like, why? I don't... He's not interesting, but they just, they stuck to that. And it's infuriating at times.
I think one of the things that honestly really probably held the series back for me was the fact that there were so many characters, you know, even if you just put aside the fact that, you know, you had like multiple guilds that they allied with. And then all of them got really stupid jokes in the finale as their big closure. Like, and then Minerva won the eating contest that Sabretooth had. And the members of Mermaid Heel became models.
Or at least Kaguya did. Who the fuck cares about the other two?
And so, but then you look at Fairy Tail itself. Probably had something like 40 fucking members or something like that. And not just like a bunch of extras. Like 40 characters with fucking names and friendships and relationships that never have really any consequence in probably like the last two thirds of the series. Like if you look, think it was like, oh god, there's Natsu, Lucy, Happy, Gray, Juvia, Carla, Urza, Laxus, Elfman, Mira Jane, Lasana, Levi, Gajeel, Levi's weird psychic group, the fucking, Kana and her husband, and not, Kana, Gildarts, frickin' Biska and her husband and their daughter, and Romeo and Romeo's dad, and,
Yeah, there are a lot
of
those.
There's just so many of them, and why?
Well, actually, this is one thing I kind of liked with Fairy Tail, is it built this huge guild, because when the series first came out, the cover page very distinctly includes characters on it who would, at the time, were kind of the characters focused on as the main characters of the guild. It was like Natsu, Gray, Lucy, Elfman, Loki, Kana, and I actually am not 100% certain if Urza's on it or not.
Oh my god, I forgot that Loki was like a character in the guild, and then it turned out that he was actually a
Stellar Spirit Mage.
Stellar Spirit, that was a big twist at the time. When was the last time he fucking showed up in the story?
He does show up during Lucy's like fight alone in the Tartarus arc, but this is actually something very significant. I don't think Lucy actually does anything of real consequence in the entirety of the last arc, except for befriends Brandish and rewrites the Book of Xerath, which we've kind of noted before was really something Levi should have done based on her magic, but that's it, you know?
Like, but Lucy's an author, Chris.
She is, which made a lot more sense when I read that one arc about the book, but other than that. But yeah, like, Luki was a character who at the start had a lot teased about him. He was this ladies' man. He had a ring magic. He had something where he was very... He didn't like stellar spirit mages for some reason. There were definitely, like, clues to who he was that we hadn't gotten fully, but they teased him as being an important member quite a lot. So there was that like, expected payoff. And this wasn't something that was just, like, they brung these up and did nothing with it. Because they did it with Elfman and then paid it off during that Phantom Lord arc when Elfman had this pretty intense fight where he had to, like, accept the death of his sister and what he had done with it and get stronger in regard, like, become stronger and embrace the same power that, you know, had killed his sister in order to protect his other sister. And at the end, him and Mira Jane share this moment where they're like, yes, Lasana's dead, but we're going to live on in her memory, and we're going to do it as a family. And you're like, what a great touchy moment. And then they bring back Lasana and do nothing with her. Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
I remember very specifically saying that when I did my catch up, like, she is literally more valuable dead than alive.
She was.
She's more...
She was,
having that reminder of, like, the importance of friendship, because, like, you know, if your friend is taken away, there's that deep loss, and there's that motivation for example, Natsu to want to help and protect Lucy, because he doesn't want another friend of his to be lost. And then she comes back, and she dresses like a cat girl, sometimes.
Yeah. She was there to fill a new kink, or something like that. It didn't really do anything. And you sit there and you're like, what was the point of this other than be like, well, don't worry, these characters can have a happy ending. And it's just like, that's not worth it. That's not what the point of this should be. But, you know, I guess maybe that's what the audience wanted. So I don't know. I've never heard people actually give a fuck about Elfman. So, I mean, outside of myself. So maybe people were just like, I wish Mira Jane was better or something. I don't know. But I just
wish that there wasn't any conflict or... intrigue or complex character motivation or anything I had to empathize with. Make everyone happy.
Yeah, everyone should just be like always like good and stuff. But like,
why do you have to have a complex way of doing things? Just have them be friends and then they win.
Yeah. Ba-da-ba-dow. But what I appreciate about Fairy Tail was that it introduced a lot of these characters and then built them up over time. Like, several times there were points where they would introduce a character and just kind of tease them a bit, give you some intrigue, but they weren't like, hey, here's, except 19 characters at once. Like Mistgun. We knew nothing about him beyond him being one of the S-ranked members of the guild, and he was very mysterious, he didn't show up a lot, and when he did, he'd put everyone in the guild to sleep and only interact with, like, the guildmaster to take new jobs. You know, like, it's kind of interesting, I wonder where they're going to go with that. Then it revealed he was Gajil from an alternate fucking, or Jalil from an alternate fucking world, and you were like, well, this is just fucking nonsense. But that was, in some ways, it worked. It worked in some ways. Like Levy. Levy was one of those characters who was just a side character at the start. We knew of, she was introduced as an extra before actually being developed in any way, shape, or form, but then later on she became a really likable character. She became Gajil's love interest. Those two had a nice relationship. There are moments like those where they built up the cast that I enjoy. Now, there are a lot of the side characters here, like, who the fuck's Biska? She has a kid, I guess. There's two cowboy characters in the guild.
She uses a sniper rifle, which is magic, I guess.
Yeah, apparently. But I can still appreciate that they didn't try to force all of these characters to be the main characters, but there are a lot of them, especially when when so many extra characters keep joining the guild. You know, it wasn't just that those characters were all there, but it's like, well, we add Gajil to it, and Juvia, and Wendy, and Laxus's group, because he has his own three people who eventually become important members in the guild. They kept...
important.
Yeah. Well, one of them dates Elfman, Nick. That's very important, right? But, like, Lasana comes back. It's just like they keep adding people onto this instead of just, like, building up the ones they have, then that's what kind of adds to Fairy Tail feeling very bloated by the end of it.
When you think about it, like, I guess to make a bit of a comparison, like, when you think about the cast of Naruto, which obviously had its fair share of characters that were horribly underutilized, but in general, like, when you had that, like, generation of kids, how many additions to it can you remember? Like,
Kai is really the only one I can think of.
That's basically it. Like, I guess if you wanted to really stretch, you could argue that Sasuke's team that he had might count, but not really.
Did they do anything?
They were only really associated with him. They didn't, like, join with the guild or anything. So, you know, there was that at least identifiable group of, you know, people of a certain generation. Obviously, there were, you know, they added in, like, you know, the Kages of other villages and stuff, or important ninja from other villages, but you could always look back and say, like, okay, who are the people who are associated with, you know, what were they called, like, the Konoha 10 or something like that, or something like Konoha 9, what, Only had 12. I don't know. The number varied based on which groups you were including, but you know, each of those set of, you know, 3-person teams was there from basically the June exam all the way through to the end. And they never like just said like, and also here's this other person who's part of them. There were additions to the cast, but they were always very different. And I don't know, I have this really big hang up of We Are Fairy Tale, and like the number of fists that get raised up, it just keeps increasing more and more, while none of them seem to be more important.
I think the issue becomes, though, it's not that they have too many characters, because you can have a lot of characters in your series and still be very good. One Piece is an example of that. But similar to the One Piece, and there is a lot of connections between One Piece and Fairy Tale, like, to be very frank. One thing I will note is Fairy Tale gets a lot of shit for always having happy endings, and for a very long time, that was the same issue with One Piece, too, where death didn't matter. Everyone came back. Pell can get hit by a nuke, but he's fine.
Nobody dies in One Piece was the joke for years, and then, well, Ace is dead. Fuck you.
And since then, they've made it a bit more clear that, like, certain members seem to have died in incidents and things like that. But there's connections there. But what One Piece does when it adds more characters and is successful with it is they usually tend to add interesting ones. Now, they're not perfect with it. Sai still sucks. No one's gonna argue against that. He's awful. So is Baby Five. A lot of them aren't very great, let's be frank. But One Piece, when it builds this huge cast, a lot of them, they give interesting personalities or things like that. There's not a lot of that with Fairy Tail. To be frank, Fairy Tail actually has a very forgettable cast, because this is the game I want to play with you, Nick.
Oh, great.
There are a lot of villains in Fairy Tail's history. I'm going to lead you a list of these villains, and I want to see if you can tell me one thing about these villains. And these are major villains. These are either main antagonists of an arc or long-running villains. Mm-hmm. So we're going to start with this. Ivan Drayar.
Was he the one associated with Urza's past?
No.
No. No. No.
It's close.
I'm gonna be miserable for the next couple of minutes. Right. Roughly same time period, maybe.
Brain.
Is the guy's name?
That was the guy's name.
Wait, hang on.
Okay.
Oh.
Oh.
Wasn't he he was like associate. Fuck, hang on. Was he associated with Cobra's group?
With the Eraseon 6 or Crime Source Array? Because he was part of 2.
I want to say he was associated with Eraseon 6.
You got it. That was the main villain of the Eraseon 6. Can you tell me what he did? What was his power? No. What was his plan? No. Yeah. The only thing I found out, I was like, oh right, he had an evil personality called Zero as well. That's about it. What about Gemma, Nick? J-I-E-M-M-A.
He was the leader of the Sabretooths. He was really mean to his guild members if they failed him. He punished Yukino by making her take her clothes off.
Well, yeah, obviously. What else would he do?
Yeah, I'm much better on that tournament arc than on some other parts of Fairy Tail.
Did you remember Jayama showed up later on after that arc as a demon?
Yeah. He showed up.
I forgot about that.
He showed up with Margear.
Yeah.
I only remember that because I was looking through those chapters
recently.
Yeah.
Arlok.
Oh. Fuck, I have no clue.
That was it was one of the members of Avatar, Nick. Also important Avatar arc.
Ooh.
Yeah, like a metal skeletal face shit going on. Blue Note Stinger.
Do you have a fake name in any of these?
I did see these are all.
No, you know, I don't know.
Blue Note Stinger. Yeah, he was a member of. I think eventually he joined up with the fucking Hades group, but Gildarts fought him on the Tenrail Island arc. He was an important character, though. He's very big at the time. Faust, Nick, you remember Faust?
No.
How can you not remember him? He was the main antagonist of the Erdos or Elseworld arc, whatever the fuck their alternate universe was. that they just stole the Lasana out of. And we're just like,
no, well, I just remember, I
well,
only remember.
Fuck you, Elseworld, Elfman, and Mira Jane.
No, I only remember Earth 2 Urza from that arc. And the fact that Panther Lily came from there because Gajito was obsessed with having his own cat buddy.
Yeah. That, look, I'm not saying that nobody would remember these characters. Nick and I'm notorious for being bad at remembering people, and Nick wasn't a huge fan of Fairy Tail. But it's worth noting that these are like 7 characters, and you were able to note a few things about one of them and identify one other. Like, Fairy Tail just had a lot of very forgettable, like, villains. And this doesn't include the fact that every single one of the people on this list had a fucking villain group associated with them.
All that had their own evil guild, yeah.
The 7 Kin of Purgatory, the 9 Gates of Tartarus, the Oration 6, Raven Tail, the various members and villains of these groups that
Raven
you could Tail be
like...
Raven
Tail was a really big deal, weren't they?
Yeah.
Because were they like the group that Fairy Tail had to really focus on during the tournament, I think?
They were supposed to be a supremely difficult group. A group that was built, because Ivan Dreyer was the leader of them. That was Makarov's son. That was Lax's dad, who was meant to be like an evil turn. He was actually the one who had planted the Lachimera that made the fake dragon slayers, like with Laxus. That's why he has lightning slayer powers. He was this big thing and built this guild, intentionally built to counter Fairy Tail's most powerful members, and it ultimately ended with Laxus defeating all of them at once. He literally beat them all in a 5-on-1 handicap match. The last thing was the puppet guy from it was teased to be joining up with Zeref's group, and it never came up again. There's a lot of these things where you're just like, there were so many characters that just that went nowhere or were just fights to have fights, you know? Look at back at the Spriggan 12, and, you know, at the time we were kind of excited because some of them felt like legitimate threats, but, you know.
Some of them got a little bit of buildup before they saw action, you know?
Yeah. But at the end of it, how many of them really had all that significant of, like, a story told within them? I mean, it's
fine. Desert.
And, you know, you could say, like, hey, it's fine to not have every character in your Battle Shonen series be relevant, like have an important backstory or anything like that. But Fairy Tail has a lot of characters and not many of them are memorable, which is sort of the issue with it. When it's this huge story that went on for so long, there's huge chunks of it. You're just like, oh, right, that happened. I completely forgot about that.
I totally get that. All right. I think that we need to wrap up our thoughts here because we've got more manga to discuss and we were going to have to go through those pretty quickly.
Yes.
Yeah. Like I said, thoughts have really not changed in the series in the last few years. I started off at one point and I'm at, there were very small bloops on the radar here and there, but for the most part, it was fun. It was stupid, dumb fun. I will say though that, I mean, Hiro definitely strikes me as a very reliably talented artist. I think that he has chops as a storyteller that he doesn't show all the time. So, hey, next time that he comes out with one, I am definitely going to be reading it. Especially because he is very reliable. Like, dude does not stop working. So, I look forward to seeing what he does next. And hopefully it doesn't quite go the same way that Fairy Tail did. We'll see.
As I said, I was a little conflicted on whether or not I strongly felt that maybe I was too harsh on it or Fairy Tail deserves everything it's got. But maybe I can kind of cement those thoughts with this top 10 I put together. Because we didn't have as many Fairy Tail festivities. But I put together top 10 reasons why Urza is just the worst, Nick. Just the worst. So, number 10, Nick, all of the weird BDSM kink stuff.
The wind just picked up as you started talking about this.
This is going to be epic, Nick. All of the weird BDSM kink stuff. Now, this isn't exclusive to Urza. All of the women in Fairy Tail get it to some point. But Urza got some of the weirdest parts of it. You know, there's that scene with Evergreen where she says, you know, strip yourself naked and prostrate yourself before me. And you're just like, what a weird request for you to do when this doesn't seem at all with your character, but whatever. But of course, the one...
Kyoka.
Yeah, that's the real one to hit on there, where you're just like, why did we get these very detailed, intricate like BDSM torture scenes with Kyoka that just went nowhere. Kyoka didn't find out anything from it because Urza didn't actually know the information Kyoka wanted. You're like, why was this a thing? I don't know. Number 9, Nick. Her skimpy armors actually actively endangered her at points. So, yeah.
They got like poisoned by a snake.
Yeah. Urza has all these sexy armors and you think like, oh, okay, whatever. Like, it's just a design aesthetic thing. Do you remember there was a point in that Oration 6 arc where Cobra's snake bites her because she decided, like, well, the best armor for this situation is a leopard print bikini. You're like, why would you not wear armor here in this situation? Like, this seems bad. Your aesthetic design is actively working against you now. Number 8, she no-sells everyone. John Cena, music, play right now, we'll go through it. There's too many instances of this to count, but one to just remember is, Kagura, who we noted having that thing at the end where she was, a grab your model now, who just seemed to not understand after the point of it.
After having a weird hero worship semi-crush slash also kinda having the hots for Jalal thing.
Yeah.
So, the last significant thing she did, I think, was giving mouth-to-mouth to Jalal.
Do you remember her fight with Urza and Minerva back in the Magic Tournament?
No. I think that she got her clothes cut off.
Well, yeah, obviously. She has this big attack, though, where she unleashes like her full power because she's very angry and driven by emotion. She released this attack that's destroying the arena, everything around it. It is ripping apart the entire area they're in. And Urza just blocks it. She just fucking stonewalls. She's like, I won't let you hurt my friends. Or some equivalent version of that happened. There are several instances where Urza just doesn't, it just doesn't work. You know?
Yep.
Number 7 here, this one might get long and I apologize for that. But this is the fake funeral, Nick. And this is what this is what I was referring to when I said there is a specific moment in Fairy Tail where you can see the series just switch on a dime. And to me, it's the fake funeral. This thing is infuriating beyond words. I feel like I've discussed it on the show or something like that, but maybe if you're a new listener, you haven't heard this yet, and maybe you don't even know that they're talking about. But there's a scene during Urza's big centric Tower of Heaven arc where she sacrifices herself into the Aetherion to save everybody. And the following chapter, this is chapter 100, a very significant chapter, it starts basically with her seeing, like, floating over and watching her own funeral as Makarov reads off a list, gives her his eulogy, essentially saying, like, you are my daughter, and the Magic Council comes up and says, hey, there's two new openings on the Council, or in the Ten Wizard Saints, and we are forever putting Urza Scarlet in as one of these members, honoring her posthumously. And Urza sees this, and then fucking Natsu just, like, slams his way in. He's like, Urza's not dead! What are we doing? This is stupid! And everyone's like, Natsu, please, this is a funeral. This is so inappropriate. No, she's not dead! She's not! Ah! And everyone just starts crying because it's a funeral, and this fucking asshole just showed up and is ruining it. He's just, like, adamantly being like, she's not dead! It's like, no, dude, why would you think that? Like, she's dead in a coffin. What are you talking about? And Urza starts...
That's a little bit of a misrepresentation now. He's really, really, really upset and in denial about her being dead, and everyone, and he just kind of upsets everyone because they've all settled and he's kind of dragging them all back. But yeah, the point is, Urza gets to see how much she means to everyone, how much they love her.
No. Urza says, I didn't want sadness. My sacrifice was to make you all happy. And it's like, bitch, it's a funeral! What were you expecting? But she's so upset by this. She's like, I know, I wanted happiness. And then she comes out of it. And we see she's not dead. She actually was saved by Natsu, who's holding her. And you're just like, fuck you. This was an entire chapter you devoted to nothing. Because this didn't happen. What was this even? Was this some alternate reality she experienced? Did she go into an alternate timeline? Did she just have a fever? What was this? But there was no point. It was just something meant to emotionally manipulate you into feeling sad and be happy Urza's back. And that's just fucking nonsense. That's the kind of storytelling I can't stand.
Which, you know, is something that Fairy Tail did all the time. All of the different, they're dead, no they're not, moments.
Yeah.
I think every single character got at least one. And some of them, you know, the reveal that they're not actually dead happened in the same chapter you were meant to think that they died. So.
And this is probably where it all, I think, the first instance of it. But yeah, there's a lot throughout it. Number six, Nick. Urza was actually good at one time. So there was a point prior to that arc where Urza was actually an interesting character, because as Fairy Tail was described as this very brash, inconsiderate, destructive guild, Urza was actually the one person that seemed to have restraint, or at least tried to establish that. She was this very disciplinary figure. Gray and Natsu were terrified of her because they'd normally butt heads, and then she'd come into the room and she'd be like, "You two, be friends with each other. Stop being dicks." And they'd be piss scared of it. And Urza was actually really interesting in this role because she was a straight man to the group that was still funny. She could still have humor, like a scene where she's describing her hypothesis on this theory of things, and in the, like, inner focus, she just falls into a trap hole. And, like, everyone, like, she has, like, a line where she's just like, "And that's why I believe, Kya!" And everyone's like, she kind of screams, like, "Kya, that's kind of cute." And then, like, she just pulls herself out of the hole and continues the theory as if nothing happened. You're like, that's funny, that's endearing. But apparently, it's much more interesting if she's just very, like, overtly sexy and she likes to, I don't know, just do really fucked up things. She eventually just becomes every other member of Fairy Tail. I made that joke last week that every member of Fairy Tail eventually could just be boiled down to a bunch of people in a room going,
That's except it. When she does it, she's kind of like, she's kind of smirking and putting her hands on her hips.
And naked. She's usually naked or in some kind of like fetish costume. And that's like, it sucks because she was far more interesting when she was the one person who wasn't always shaking her head at it, but she was at least like, somebody in this group needs to be, like, level-headed, I think. Number five, Nick, the Christmas chapter.
Where she gets everyone to play, like, Truth or Dare, essentially, and somehow she ends up... She does it because she's jealous that all of the girls are getting close to their love interest and not her. And then she ends up taking a dare where she walks out into the street naked, and she runs into Joel!
That would be a thing in and of itself, but it's worth noting, this is a chapter in which Urza essentially sexually assaults every single member of her guildmates.
All of them.
Just in the worst ways, and it's, of course, a comedy chapter. It's this hilarious chapter where she says, "Hey, Levi and Juvia, molest Lucy's tits," and they are forced to do it. And then she's like, "Gray, get naked and Natsu spank his ass," and they do it. And it's like, as a reader, you're supposed to be like on the floor, like, ha, 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 ha. It's funny that she's doing what we want to see because we want to see naked characters or things like that, I guess. But oh man, it's so funny. She makes Wendy dress up like a maid. This is funny. No, it is really, really weird. This chapter's fucked up. I don't know how much we're supposed to consider canon because it's like an extra chapter, but it's drawn by Hiro, so in every ways, this is like canon enough that it's like, this is fucked up. Number four, Nick, Jalal.
Just
throughout
Jalal.
The entire series, it is one of the longest running plots of Fairy Tail, and it is just awful. No one gives a fuck about Jalal and Urza's relationship. Can you, like, is there anything that really... No, you don't. You don't, because you don't have experience with enough things to recognize that this is just lifeless and awful. Their relationship goes...
How does it resolve, Chris? They can be with each other. They don't. Yeah, but Urza starts brushing her hair.
Urza's, gonna start combing her hair, essentially.
He's been pardoned and forgiven, and he can be a free man, and he can be together with Urza. They can love each other the way that they always have. And Urza decides that she's going to acknowledge this by brushing her hair.
Yeah. People have said that, you know, it's a very touchy relationship because they're star-crossed lovers, but it's just really... There's nothing interesting about the two of them together. Jalal himself is a pretty awful character, but the fact that this happens over and over and over, at least every significant arc in the series features some point where Urza has to be like, "Jalal's here?" And we delve into that, is fucking...
And everyone looks over and is like, "Is Urza here?"
Number three, her powers don't make sense. To this day, I still don't understand what Urza's power set is supposed to completely do. At the start, it makes sense. She has this collection of different armors. but they all seem to have different purposes. This armor is super defensive. This armor is strong against fire magic. This armor increases my throwing power. These all make sense. But then later on, she just seems to have better armors around. Just the, like, this armor has 19 telekinetic swords that I can attack you with. And it's like, why didn't we use that one from the start in most fights? She's like, I don't know.
Didn't she end up winning a bunch of her fights by just punching people by the end, too?
There's a significant fight in the Tower of Heaven arc where she learns that it's not about having magic weapons. It's more about, like, her actual talent with a swordsman. And that's where she has, like, the samurai pants and, like, the tie top combo. But then she uses that thing in, like, three other fights, and it really kind of distracts from it.
That's the big favorite, because, you know, she's got bound boobs, so.
Yeah. It's just strange to me, though, that, like, her power set has no exploration or growth to it. She just, like, here's a new set of armor, and it's sexier. It's like, this one seems stronger, though. Did she buy this recently, or why didn't she just wear this before? And it's like, Mike, I feel like I need a... All right, whatever. Number two, Nick. Because she's Urza.
We thought about covering this for Weekly Manga Recap Lives. Just for this one moment, we thought about covering this chapter. Decided against it, because, you know, they were just better dialogue chapters. But yeah, I guess to set the scene, it's her fight with Kyoka.
Yes.
Who, basically can manipulate the senses. Yes. To this point, she's been doing it to do her kink thing, you know, increase pain, increase sensitivity in various different ways and stuff. This way, she shuts it off. She cuts off the senses. So Urza can't see, she can't hear, she can't taste, she can't smell, she can't even touch, she can't feel by touch. And Urza manages to find a way.
A key thing to this, she has everything turned off except her pain receptors, which are turned up to maximum. So the simplest paper cut would feel like a blade is carving right through her skin.
So Kyoka starts to beat the shit out of her. And Urza manages to start fighting back. And everyone's like, well, maybe if she's gotten her senses cut off, maybe it's the fact that she has some sort of sixth or seventh sense that's allowing her to fight back. And Happy says, I have a much simpler explanation. It's because she's Urza! And literally everyone else who's listening to it is like, no, that makes sense. Urza sure is awesome. I totally believe she could do that.
I fucking despise Urza.
We're only at number two, though.
So the number one reason that Urza is just the worst, Nick, is because despite all of those reasons mentioned, people actually think she's a good character. I don't get this! The reason these things happen is because Urza is apparently insanely popular. And she gets to do all these things because it makes people... How does nobody else... Like, how do people see all this stuff and are just like, fuck yeah! Urza can beat all 100 monsters! Fuck your challenge! Meaningless now! Suck my cock! Urza wins because she's just Urza, because that's how fucking awesome she is! Yeah!
Oh my god.
She is awful. She is terrible. I cannot comprehend why people would like her. Now, I'm not saying if you're a fan of her that you have a bad opinion, you have a bad thought. Maybe it's just be that, you know, she's somebody who connects to your personal interests, or maybe you just haven't, you know, you're new to reading manga, you haven't seen a whole lot of options. Or, you know, you just, you know, like, hey, she has tits and a sword. I don't know. The fact of the matter, though, is she's not a good character. And I've seen people who hold her up as, like, what a strong, powerful female, role model. And it's like, no. I will give Urza credit and Fairy Tail for being one of the few battle shonen manga that do give their female characters, like, fights more than other series. But that doesn't mean they're good at, like, representation. Remember, option 5 on this list was Urza sexually assaulting all of her friends because she was jealous that they got to be with their love interests. She's not a good role model. She's terrible. She's very poorly written. She is trying way too hard, and she's just awful. I cannot understand her. All these reasons I feel like should be easily why you wouldn't like her, but for some reason, despite this, She is insanely popular and people love her, Nick. That's why I don't think I can give Fairy Tail a recommendation, because I hate this series so much because it just brings out my most negative emotions, but some people like it, so for those people, I'm happy you enjoy it. I'm not trying to take that away from you. But if you have not read Fairy Tail and you want to know if it's good or not, it's not. It's fucking worthless dribble garbage that has no meaning, wastes your time, and actively insults you as a reader. Fuck Fairy Tail.
And that's it for Urza Scarlet, a.k.a. the red-headed swordsman Roman Reigns of manga. So.
Roman Reigns loses sometimes!
All right, we're going to go into the weekly manga recap portion of weekly manga recap. It is, yeah. So, we don't have to do Fairy Tail this week, obviously, and we don't have to do One Piece, but we still do have a lot of chapters to go through, so let's try and hit this really quickly. We're gonna start off with My Hero Academia, number 147, Touga! Because twice in Touga, Chris. Touga. Touga. Anyway, so, the heroes are trying to make their way past Irinaka, aka Mimic, who is trying to crush them now in the corridor that they have. In order to combat this, the really douchebaggy hero that's been with them this whole time, introduces his power. His name is Rocklock, and he has a power called Deadbolt. Anything that he locks down by touching it gets locked in place, which is an interesting ability. Problem is, he can't stop all the walls. So, yeah. We get a little bit of an introduction, a closer introduction to Irinaka, and he doesn't look like a little diminutive little thingy. He's this large man in suspenders. Very large man, it looks like. He's got weird hair, too.
He's trying to hold in a dump, it looks like.
Is. And yes, he clarifies that he's using quirk boosters so that he can control this entire freaking building around them. But, Deku is all determined because, you know, he knows that Ryukyu and her students, the heroes, the police, are all relying on them, and, they've got to save Eri, so he's not gonna give up. And then all of a sudden they just kinda get dumped in, little freaking area. They get that's dropped in there because it's time for the borrowed people from the Villain Alliance to try and attack them. And Touga comes flying in from out of nowhere, manages to stab Locke in the hand, get a bunch of his blood on it. He uses his locking ability to stop her and then tries to attack her, but oh no, it was a double the whole time. And the real Touga comes up from the other direction and snatches the knife away. It's actually a really clever little tactic. It's a quick little shadow clone kind of thing. Touga says something very strange in introducing herself, which is, I'm now a protected treasure from a golden era. A real nasty gangster.
I think that's her way of referencing the fact that they're working with the Yakuza now.
I guess. It's odd.
I mean, she is insane.
She is crazy. Yes. I don't even know what the fuck happens. So, okay. As a result of having the blood, now she, of course, is able to transform into him. Deku and Aizawa come across him after this has happened. They get confused and tricked. Touga, while taking the form of Lockrock, tries to sneak attack Midoriya. And, she's trying to stab him and stuff. Aizawa manages to protect Deku at the last minute, snagging her with his bandage thing and yanking her away. She's naked underneath her disguise. Don't know why, but she is. I guess she might only be able to use her power while naked because her clothes can't transform? In which case, I don't know why she was dressed in clothing when she first attacked him. That seems like a little bit of a waste of time.
Well, this was something that didn't just show up during the hero exam arc when she was
she was naked when she was floating around and stuff, yes.
And we thought that was just because that was that one girl's power, but...
Right.
Yeah.
So it would make sense if, you know, like you can change your physical body, but you can't change your clothes. Okay, sure. I'm just confused as to why she was bothering to attack Lockrock while wearing her clothes, though, because that would, you know, you would have to stop and take your clothes off and then transform.
Because it's the fall season, Nick, and schoolgirl outfits are in, and she is chic, if nothing else.
Get with the program. She manages to graze Aizawa with the knife as well. She then acts really creepy while going back to her instruments and stuff. We get a flashback as she's like, I think sniffing her own clothing? I don't know. Anyway, Overhaul got Shigaraki to play shogi with him. And he's like, I don't know the rules. Stop it. And he's like, you should learn. See, my favorite part of this game is how you can utilize pieces stolen from the opponents. So, you know, you can give me a few of these guys and then I'll have them run amok with me. It's a very, very simple chess, metaphor. I don't know. I'm used to them being a bit more complex than you can use someone else's pieces in shogi. So I would use your pieces because we're working together in different teams.
Manga doesn't have great chess metaphors.
No.
I was just remembering the one in Fairy Tail where Jamal's doing it during his whole fucking arc, and he's just like, I guess that's it for the Stella Spirit Mage. And then she wins, like, immediately afterwards. It's like, did you just not wait to see if she died? You're really presumptuous on this shit.
Hmm. Twice shows up with the big, brawly, chargy guy from the opening at the gate to confront Sir Night Eye, and that's where the chapter ends. It's really just kind of setting up a couple of different confrontations involving these two. There's some things that are said that I really feel as though I'm just not getting, unfortunately, the meaning behind.
Part of it, I think, is also Toga's just meant to be kind of a little bit off-kilter and just weird, so you kind of have to go with that. But it's fine. Like, I'm kind of be interested to see where this goes, particularly if, like, Aizawa ends up kind of getting screwed, since he seems like one of those really big, like, pillars of support right now for their team. So I'm curious to see how that goes.
Alright. No fairy tale this week. Or ever. Again. And so we're gonna move on to Astral Lost in Space. Everyone is basically getting ready to finish up on planet Icarus. And, they're getting ready to start off. So we kind of have a little bit of a reunion with, Paulina and, the kids. And, they're getting ready to all set off. There's a brief moment where Yunhua just, sings a song that apparently Funi wrote.
Sure.
It's not, yeah, she's a regular old lyricist with the, yeah. I can't criticize the writings of an 8-year-old, okay, Chris?
Oh, I will. Fuck that kid. I hope she falls.
Everyone is, you know, looking ready to go. Bright and cheery and happy. There's a cake. There's a very bizarre comedy moment where Kanata explains that he has put his anti-grav shoes over his crust suit boots. I don't know really why. He's like, oh, just want to see if it'll work in an emergency. Like, I guess if he has to really quickly put on his anti-gravity shoes? I don't know. He says, like, oh yeah, if we got it like this, you know, when we went outside with Lena, then it would have been way easier to grab the dog tags instead of pole vaulting and stuff. And of course, this all leads to a wacky moment because they bring out the cake while he's wearing his anti-gravity boots. And he's like, woohoo! And he jumps in joy and he hits his fucking head on the ceiling and causes a whole bunch of chaos because he set off the artificial gravity and everyone falls over except for Olgar, who's just kind of like chilling while floating through the air reading a book. I do appreciate that. The joke is the fact that he's completely unaffected by the chaos around him. They set off. They take off. Go out into space again. Zack says, I can see it! So Luca, quick as a goddamn whip, says, scoping out Kidori's panties, are you?
I like how she addresses, she's like, I don't, like, how would he even be doing that? He's looking out into space. Like, I can understand if you make that joke a few pages ago when like Aries fell over and you were saying, oh, look at her pants. Like he's like up there. I'm like right here. How was he doing that? Luke is like, you fucker, you killed my joke.
The thing that Zach says that he's actually talking about is that because they scavenged certain parts, or rather switched out the different sections of the Astro with the Arc 6 in order to repair it, there are certain functions that were broken in the Astro that now work on their new hybrid ship, including the Deep Space Telescope, so they can actually see home. And he brings it up on the screen, everyone's like, oh wow, home, yeah, we can actually see it, it feels a lot closer, you know, it feels like we can actually make it there. So yeah, we're gonna do it now, we're gonna get there, that's the last point on our journey, we're gonna make it. And Paulina comes in, and she looks at their home, and she's like, oh, wow, I can see Earth! And she gets really, really emotional because she's been gone for so long, she's getting to go home. And then she's like, yeah, I've dreamed of seeing this so many times, seeing those oceans and continents. Wait a minute. She looks closer, and she's like, is that supposed to be, like, Africa? It's not quite right, and that mask doesn't look like... This looks kind of wrong. It looks similar to Earth, but it's not Earth, or that's a different planet. What the hell's going on? And everyone's like, what's planet Earth? And she's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Earth is Earth. And everyone says, we have no idea what you're talking about. And she says, are these guys aliens from another planet, actually? Are they not actually from, but they speak English, and they look human, but they've never heard of it. What the hell planet do you come from if you're not from Earth? And Kanata's like, where do we come from? Planet Astra. And it's a very odd and unsettling sequence, not just because of, you know, you're suddenly put inside of Paulina's head as she's having these racing, paranoid thoughts, but also because for probably the first time, you're kind of put in the perspective of a character outside of the main cast. All of a sudden, these, you know, characters that we've been following for, you know, 30-something chapters to this point, now they're like the others when they've been the heroes this whole time. And it's really telling that a lot of what you see from their interaction is just Paulina looking at the group while they stare in befuddlement at her. It's a very effective way of making this shocking reveal. It's probably the biggest twist that I can think of in the last few years, honestly. But they're not from Earth. That said, I'm not sure that I believe that this was supposed to be the twist all along.
It is very horror movie-esque, which I like. And I've heard a lot of people talk about this twist. I guess I just don't quite get it. Like, I'm like sitting here, I'm like, all right, but what does this mean? Like, is it meant to be like, oh, but they're all aliens from another world, or...
Well... I'm just waiting for
what the actual implication for this is.
Mm-hmm. And there are some theories that I have about it. You know, keep in mind that, you know, this is a society that is master cloning, and also that these guys got stranded in a faraway galaxy because they essentially went through a wormhole. And also, it was set up very early on when Paulina was joined the ship that she and her crew had discovered some sort of potential impending calamity towards Earth. You know, she was surprised that such time had happened, that had passed, and that nothing bad had happened to the kids, that their planet was still there. So maybe something happened where Earth, or rather the humanity, had to just kind of very quickly travel to a different place that was very similar to Earth. The big twist really is the fact that the kids have no idea what Earth actually is, and there's only like 20 years or so separation between them. So how is that possible?
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is like, is this meant to imply that there is no Earth at all in this universe and there's some parallel dimension thing going on, or they
possibly
just don't know of Earth, but it exists and they're like from a different planet. I think this twist is interesting, but it's not on like the level I thought it was when people talked about it. Cause I was expecting them to be like, what's planet Earth? She knows too much, and they just snap her neck and, like, start eating her or something like that. I'm like, oh, my God, this is crazy. But instead, I'm just like, okay, let's see where this goes.
I don't know. Well, the thing is that does bother me about this, though, just a little thing, and I mean, I'm curious to see how, if it gets addressed, and I actually was bringing this up with Annalise over Twitter. When the kids named the ship the Astra, they got it from a plaque on the ship that was, you know, a Latin phrase, you know, to the stars. And they were like, Astra, what's that? It's from a plaque in here. It means stars. Why the fuck would you need to say that if the fucking planet you're from is Astra?
Haven't you ever had that moment, Nick, where you show up, you're just like, this ship is called Earth. What does Earth mean? It means the world, essentially.
It means, like, you know, the foundation. It's what we walk upon. It's the dirt and soil that we build our civilization on.
I'm like, good.
Also, it's the planet we live on.
Good. Name the ship the Sassy Earth.
We are naming our ship the Moon after asses.
As we do. And that one booze without the other half of the word. Maybe it's all Ulgar because Ulgar's the only person there. I don't know. I'm just noting things. It's a 5 chapter. I just don't really know what the implications of the twist are quite yet.
We'll have to find out more, but I am curious how that gets addressed. Let's go on then to Food Wars Shokugeki no Soma. We get a lot more focus on Somei and Mimasaka's part of the team battle in this chapter. Also, Somei is apparently ripped as fuck. Jesus Christ, look at that. Look at that boy.
Why wouldn't he be, Nick? It's Food Wars. Everyone is crazy ripped in this, it feels like.
He doesn't look so ripped when he's wearing his, you know, kimono thing, so. Anyhow, everyone is still reacting to the fact that the Mimasaka has managed to so well copy Somei. There's a nice little exchange in the chapter where Somei says... First off, there's a little joke because, like, Mimasaka is, you know, acting like Somei now. He's like, this one is called Somei Saito, dedicated to walking the path of the chef. And Somei's like, you know, for all my talk of Bushido, though, I have never referred to myself as this one. Your image training is so incomplete if you think that I'm that way. And literally, like, every member of the council of Stan's like, what are you talking about? You always talk about yourself like that. Yeah, you do. Yeah, you use this one all the time. Frickin', like, Megishima chimes in from the other side. He's like, yeah, I've heard you do that, too. Everybody calls him out on that, which is it's just kind of funny.
Yeah.
But Somei does this cool thing where after he fillets his tuna to prepare his dish, he then offers his sword over to Mimasaka. Everyone calls it a knife. That's a big fucking knife, if you want to call it that. I guess he's using it as a cooking knife, so fair enough. It's a freaking sword, though.
Can't say it's a big knife and not do a Crocodile Dundee reference, though.
Yeah, it's a knife. So,
nailed it.
But Somei says that, like, hey, you know, if you're going to actually be mimicking me, then it's going to be inferior if you do not use, you know, my beloved knife, or it will be unfair. It will go against my code of honor, and I won't allow that. So I was like, he really is really super samurai chivalry, huh? But I think it's a cool character moment for him, where he's like, hey, if you're going to actually copy me, do it some frickin' justice and use the proper tools to do it. And Mimasaka does, and then they continue with different swords and different knives, rather. And we get a little bit of insight after we see, you know, a cooking montage between them of Mimasaka practicing, because turns out he didn't just use his super photography thing. He actually did a lot of image training on all the members of Central. And it was taking a big toll on him because he couldn't just prepare for one opponent because he had no idea who he was going to be matched up against. So he prepared to copy all of them. Which starts off very dramatic because, you know, he's wearing himself out. He's tired. He's got to do it multiple times in a row while practicing. He's like, but, you know, I can't give this up for the sake of, you know, what I was taught by Takumi Aldini and Soma Yukihira. They're the reason I'm standing in a kitchen at all right now, and I must repay the debt I owe them. I can't lose. Which is really cool, I think. You know, calling upon that actual character history that they have. And, I mean, I actually been rereading parts of Shokugeki no Soma recently. The stuff with Mimasaka during his introduction is really good. Like, seriously. So I'm like, I like seeing this callback to that. And then we get just a montage of him just in different, you know, freaking wigs and outfits, mimicking the different members of Central, and including Aizan just going, I hate Yukihira! I hate Yukihira! Also, apparently Kuni Kuni is super tsundere. We didn't really get enough insight on her, I think, for me to get that during she was her actual Shokugeki with Soma. Okay.
It'd be great if we see him doing his image training for the ninth seat and he just lays on the floor with the baseball cap.
He does it for freaking Julio. He just draws a butt chin on. He reaches a point where he's like, okay, you know, now's the time for me to go on my own path. The tracing is done. And now is when I'm going to take one step beyond him. We get to see Somei's dish first. It's a bunch of bite-sized little sushi rubies. And they're like, oh, but hey, check out Miyusaki. He's doing something that wasn't part of Saito Senpai's cooking. What's that he's brought out? That's the end of the chapter.
Yeah, more if they actually make Miyusaka seem, more interesting going into this, then I think it'll be interesting. Like that it's not just gonna be, full on, like, oh, he wasn't good enough to copy this dude, he sucks. But, they're building it up so that, like, when the result comes, it's gonna feel interesting either way.
I really do like the fact that this second round of battles has more of a focus on all of them, as opposed to, so was fighting Kuni Kuni. Also, Ishiki's over here with this other guy. Hey, look, that third guy lost to Miyusaka. Yeah. Not Miyusaka, Mikishima.
Yeah.
Makes it feel like more like a team competition if we actually see all the members of the teams.
Did you say? A team competition! No, you did. My voice already hurt.
Dr. Stone! Z equals 21, Dawn of Iron. Last time, Senku discovered that Chrome had a freaking magnet lying around. They have gone around the riverbed, gathering up iron sand in order to use it. There is a really weird, just art joke, because, they're just kinda like, oh wow, man, that Kohaku, she's like really got all that energy and stamina, huh? And, Senku and Chrome are just talking about how she is. And Chrome's exact words are, we have plenty of monstrous gorillas in our village. Kuhaku's the only nimble gorilla. And Kuhaku gets really pissed off that she's called a gorilla. And she's like, I'm the only one who's actually doing any fucking work. Why don't you guys get off your asses and get back to it? But like, it's not that her face gets super demented when she says it. It's that her body stays the same size and her head expands really big up on this huge neck in order to yell down at them. It's really creepy looking.
It's a great joke, though.
It's a great little visual gag, and I love that they're just looking up going, ah! We're introduced to another member of the village, Suika, who is this, I guess, little girl looking, I think it's a girl. I'm not quite sure.
I don't know if we get a gender. But
I don't think so. It's this little kid who is wearing a large melon rind, basically, on their head. Very bizarre looking thing. But anyhow, Suika is just joining up with them in order to help out. Just because. There is actually an explanation, which is, hey, you know, I'm always wearing this thing. I can't actually help people out much because it makes me clumsy and I can't see very much. But, you know, I want to help out when I can. So, and, she starts to launch into this big speech about wanting to do this. And Senku is just kind of like, hey, no, it's all right. You know, I can help. The science kingdom needs all the help it can get. So I won't turn anyone away. And, also, you know, you're really good at gathering all this stuff. So sure, come along with us. And Suika's like, no one has ever asked Suika why Suika has ever not asked Suika why Suika wears this thing. He must have realized Suika doesn't want to show Suika's face and didn't bother Suika about, you better start using some fucking pronouns, kid.
I, Suika,
have gathered the Book of Ends.
He must have realized that I just don't want to show I, Suika's face and didn't bother Suika about it.
Very, very brief little introduction to the character, but I do like the small interaction that they have with Senku, where just like, I don't care. You're gonna help me. Fine. There is, let's see here. Blah, 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 blah. Senku here is about Momotaro. Like, Crow makes a Momotaro reference while they're going around, and so Senku's like, so, you guys never heard of fucking Dragon Quest or Monster Hunter, but you know about Momotaro. So why do you know about that? And like, oh yeah, well see, Ruri tells us all sorts of stories, and so they've told us about the tale of Momotaro. You know, he's the one of the animal buddies that he recruits with Dango treats, and like, there's just this weird visual of, I'm not sure how to describe it exactly. So Momotaro is described as this JoJo-looking fucker who basically befriends huge monstrous animals that are wearing spikes and shit. I don't know enough about Momotaro to explain why this is weird, so.
Wasn't it Kenshiro?
Was it?
I mean, that looks like
that
Kenshiro.
It looks like Kenshiro, yes. But, hang on. Momotaro. Well, there's a character in frickin' folklore named Momotaro. I don't know.
I think they're just saying that, like, they turned, like, the legend of Momotaro into, like, a shonen battle series, essentially.
I guess. That makes sense why Senku would. I don't know enough about Japanese culture. Anyway, so Senku observes, like, oh, hey, you know, there's this version of the story that's, you know, kind of where all the animals are fierce and dangerous, and, basically, Senku is like, huh, my interest in this Ruri person has really been piqued, so I really do actually want to cure her so I can kind of understand what the hell she's about. And Crow was just like, wait, you're interested in Ruri? What's up with that, Senku? And Senku's like, what the hell is up with you, man? And Kohaku kind of like calls Senku over and is like, Crow's gonna get like a, and he's like, okay, alright, yeah, sorry. It's actually really cool the way that it's like this idea is communicated, because she doesn't really use words. She kind of just like, it's almost like she just kind of sends him psychic wavelengths or something like that. It was like, Chrome has a fucking thing for Ruri. And I was like, oh, gotcha. All right. He's an idiot. Cool. They, in order to actually use iron, they have to use this iron sand, combine it with some stuff, and set it to a 1500 degrees Fahrenheit. So good fucking luck with that. They they use this kiln thing to start doing it, and are just using bellows to try and raise the heat. There's a 2-page spread of them really, really desperately trying to raise the temperature and killing themselves doing it. Because they get exhausted too quickly, because they have to maintain the heat for several dozen hours. Yay! Anyway, the point is that Senku needs more manpower in order for the Kingdom Science to be realized. He really, really, really is missing Taiju right now. We cut over to Ginro and Kinro. Kinro is still like, hey, don't go help them. No, they're not allowed in. And Ginro's like, oh, you know, but you've got that golden spear. You know, but why aren't you helping? And he's like, no. See, just because I have this spear doesn't mean I won't help them. He's like, okay, well then switch spears with me. No! I want the spear. They get exhausted. They fail. Senku is like, we need more help. Senku looks over and is like, oh hey, that Ginro guy looks like he's just about won over. We are probably going to need to find various different ways in order to actually recruit a bunch of different villagers, though. We need intelligence and find out what we can actually offer them in order to recruit them, though. And Suika's like, well, I'm really good at this kind of thing. Suika can just be disguised as a watermelon and sneak around learning things. To demonstrate this, Suika just falls to the ground and the watermelon just, like, hides them from view.
Sure. I think it's ambiguous.
Why not? Hey, look, there's a watermelon lying in the middle of the ground here.
I'm not going to question it, though. Unless it starts moving. Nope, it's still. All right, we're good.
Senku is like, in the quest for iron workers, Great Detective Suika is on the case. So I guess we're doing this now. Dr. Stone's been weird lately, hasn't it?
It's been fun. It's interesting seeing, I guess, the way they're, like, slowly recruiting various different people from this town. But, it's been interesting, certainly. I didn't think we'd be spending this long on just the Sanctum's part. But I guess it makes sense that this is the one that's going to be involving new characters.
I would assume that we're going to get some sort of, like, a bunch of new developments kind of introduced at once, maybe, when we cut back over to Taiju and Yuzuriha. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right.
We never learn. Chapter 25. It all begins with the genius's struggles with X. So this one's a Takemoto chapter, and it's about how she's doing well in school. Her times are getting worse in her swimming. But she's like, I'm actually good because I'm going to focus on it. Like, they're like, hey, your times are bad. She's like, don't worry, I got it. So she starts swimming even harder.
All right, swimsuit wedgie, let's do this shit.
I think there's actually not actively any time where she wedgie snaps her swimsuit. So this is a very shocking chapter. But she gets right back on the horse, and she's not only getting back to her usual times, she's coming close to like setting new records. And everyone's like, wow, really good. But her friends are kind of knowing, like, hey, like, don't do this too hard, because we all know your big weakness is you don't pace yourself. It's your big problem. She's like, don't worry, I got this. We see that she's not doing great, though. She comes home, immediately, like, hits the bed and just, like, passes out. But then she's like, oh, wait, hold on, I got to study. So she's clearly not gaining enough rest. But thus far, everything seems to be working. She's doing well at school. She's doing well in her time. Everything's going well. Ha ha, they're all at lunch. And then she leaves. She's like, got to go get my study on. And that's for her. She's like, oh, my God! She didn't eat all of her popsicles! Something's wrong! Call the police! Superman! Superman!
What is it, Fumino? Is it murder? Is there some sort of robbery? A hostage situation? No! No! She left a pot sticker!
Pot sticker still on the plate? Yeah, because she left a pot sticker on her plate. That's abnormal! Takemoto's always just eating, like, never leaves anything behind, so something's definitely wrong. So Yuiga's like, yeah, that's a bit strange. I'm gonna go after her. And he's like, hey, Takemoto, how are you doing? And he happens to catch her right at the time that Takemoto just collapses out of exhaustion, because she's hit her limit. So he takes her to the nurse's office to rest, and he's like, you know, I apologize for not, you know, being more careful and being more observant of you and the point that you were putting yourself to. And he's like, you're really so dedicated. I bet you, whoever you have a crush on is a really lucky guy. And that's when, like, her in her, like, kind of dazed sleep kind of, like, cradles around and embraces Yuiga, and he's like, oh, this is weird. I'm gonna kinda like it. Oh, wait, no, I should move. This is, like, really weird. I don't know why I did that. And that's when a bunch of fellow classmates, like, burst into the room, and they're like, we heard you fainted. Are you okay? So Yuiga hides himself underneath the bed and is listening in as these classmates talk about how, oh, she looks like she really, you know, put herself out too much, but, you know, maybe she didn't want to worry her crush. And everyone's like, oh, and Yuiga's underneath here, and, you know, listen, they say, I wonder who she has a crush on. And someone's like, oh, please, it's obvious. It's Yuiga-senpai. And that's when Yuiga realizes, maybe that person she has a crush on is me. That's it.
So, yeah. Honestly, good chapter. I do want to make one note. The girls' shower stall doors are ridiculously pointless. Those things must be like 2 feet tall.
It's very much like
nothing.
It's very much like, all right, well, this will barely cover most of your ass so long as you fit in a very specific height range. I assume...
We hope that you aren't 4'6".
Yeah, like, if Ogata were in one of those stalls right now, it would cover nothing.
She would, like, just be, like, she would almost be able to look underneath it without any doubt.
Yeah, you'd basically just be like, is there a person in there, or is that just a pair of legs coming out? She's just, like, waves the wheelchair. I'm like, no, I'm here.
So, also, they seem to, like, vary in height, like, as the scene goes on. It starts off, it looks like their shoulder height. Later on, it looks like their waist height. Like, eh. Later on, it looks like their ass height. Like,
yeah, it seems pointless, but what are you gonna do?
Maybe the shower doors, like, go up and down, and you have to time it in order to make it to the next level. You just like you have to time it so that
you can't be indecent. If you expose anything, then you have to start over from level one.
Right,
it's like insultingly slow at that point. You're just like, oh, I get it. All right, I'll do better.
Seriously, this was actually a nice chapter. I do like the fact that it's showing that, hey, you know, this work is actually making progress and stuff, and it's not like she's just becoming, you know, I like the real note of, hey, you know, it's really, really hard to focus on these two different things, you know, to focus on your athletics and to focus on your studies. But she just, you know, goes for it and she ends up kind of paying the price. And hey, you know what? I am all in favor of any romantic comedy series that actually bothers to advance the relationships, little by little. So the fact that Yuiga has learned about this, it's probably a bit too early, but
well,
I prefer it to him not learning about it for like 100 chapters.
The thing to note is that it's not that he heard it from her mouth. He heard some girl hypothesize that he's the person she has a crush on.
Right.
So you could very easily next chapter just be like, she's like, no, not, that's not it. And he's like, I'll take you at your word because I'm an honest boy. Or it could be not that at all. And they go ahead with it. And it's like, hey, you know what? We're trying to be a different kind of harem series. I don't know, but, I think it seems like it's moving at least in interesting direction.
All right. Let's move on to the Promised Neverland. Emma learns to shoot a bow and arrow. Okay.
Yeah, so, it's the Hunger Games now, guys. Hunger Games with demons.
I did see a lot of people making Katniss Everdeen jokes. Come on. All right. So, yeah.
Katniss Everdeen. No, I meant she was Petra, Nick. Or Peter. What is his name? Peter? PETA? He was some stupid fucking not name that sounds too close to Peter, but isn't.
Anyway. Both of our two main heroes learned something new. Ray's learned to cook. Okay. A valuable skill while surviving out in the wilderness. Do not get me wrong, but it's just a very sudden little thing. They're like, oh my God, this is delicious. What is it? And Ray's like, my cooking.
Right, it's like, I guess you don't know, but
it's
I know
all
about
organic.
He's like, I tried it. I used a little bit of Jamaican palm spices. I don't know if it fully brought out all the flavor of the macaroni and cheese, but I feel as though it might have. I'm going to try a couple unique things, although I might have to find someone with better palates than you to totally judge it. They're like, Ray, if you just make mac and cheese and shut the fuck up, we just compliment you, okay? I don't know why you have to do this and make it harder on yourself.
I like mac and cheese. So we just get a little bit of a catch up, which is that the kids have been going along with their two demon buddies, going underground, making their way closer and closer to their destination. Sonju tells them that the best way for them to actually reach their destination is to actually go from, instead of just going directly southeast, go up through the north side of the forest and then kind of loop back around because that way they don't go into any wild demon territory. Cool. Ray's learned to cook. Emma's learned to shoot a bow and arrow. She's holding a bow backwards in one of the shots where she shoots a bow and arrow, but she shoots a bow and arrow. Yay!
You'd think at this point that myth would have been, like, removed. Like, for such a smart series, they would have been like, well, let's not do the people are shooting a bow wrong thing, but, eh, fuck it.
Emma freaking, goes along with, Sanju, to go, up and scout around when he just kind of like goes up to the surface. There's actually a really cute little shot of them on his demon horse thing coming outside because Emma's in this freaking like massive oversized cloak riding along with this giant spear wielding demon. Sonju says to her, hey, you know, I know you didn't just come up here just because you wanted to take a look around too. So what do you want to talk about? And Emma's like, okay, I want you to teach me how to kill a living thing. You know, you've taught us a lot of different things, but I haven't actually hunted on my own. All the food that we had was prepared by someone else. You know, this is stuff that we have to be able to do to survive on our own. At first, I thought that she was actually asking me, like, hey, I need to be able to freaking kill people so that we can fight back. No, she's just like, teach me how to, you know, capture, kill, and eat an animal. I need you to do that so that we can actually survive out here. And so, yep, they go and she takes down this, bird. Shoots down out of the sky, and then Sanji says, okay, so next what you need to do is you need to use the Gupna. And I was like, what the hell is that? He pulls out this little flower, and he says, it's a vampiric plant called Vida. They grow wild anywhere. You need to pierce this through the heart of your game. that you dedicate to the food to the gods, and if the gods accept, the flower will bloom, and then you can eat the meat. This is Gupna, is how demons traditionally slaughter meat. And it has also, like, health benefits, too. So, Emma thinks about this for a second, because she's like, this is kind of how they've been killing us, and putting these flowers in our body now. It's nice to have that explanation, by the way, of why flowers were blooming from the corpses that they found. But Sanju first off offers a little bit of comfort because he sees that she's distressed, you know, and she's talking about it, and he's like, hey, you know, if it makes you feel any better, your siblings didn't actually suffer. You know, it's a completely painless procedure, so it gives them a peaceful death. Anywho, Emma performs the ceremony, pierces the bird's heart with the flower, and offers up in prayer, and Emma is just kind of thinking to herself as they head back after she's done successfully, we don't want to be eaten, we want to live, but we've been eating others too, and if we don't continue to eat, we can't survive. We have to eat. And there's a really bizarre little moment, because Sanju realizes Emma is deep in thought as he's looking down at her, and he's like, so, hey, what's wrong? And Emma turns back around her shoulder and looks at him and just goes, nothing. And she looks fucking evil in that one picture.
Yeah, we've gotten a few of those shots before, though, where the kids say something and they look insidious while they do it. Never really pans out to anything. I just don't get why her, like, inner thought process, like, we've had to eat others to get to this point. I was like, did they ever state that you guys have been eating other kids? Or, like, I get, like, maybe it's hard for her to reconcile the idea of any living creature being, like, different. Like, that's a whole argument in of itself.
I mean, she is 12, so.
But the way she phrases it without changing the specifying kind of point of it does make it sound like she's insinuating they've been eating others, like, other kids, you know?
Well, you have to think of it this way. This entire time, they have essentially been prey, and now they have to, in order to survive, be predators in a certain respect. So I think it's a matter of a kind of a loss of innocence type of thing.
I guess. Maybe it just needed to be a little bit longer of a sentiment, because here it just feels short, and the context is hard to grasp completely.
Tell you what I do like, though, is that at the very end of the chapter, they get back to the cave, and Ray just kind of ruffles her hair and says, stop doing everything yourself. So he kind of knows what the hell's going on, but he doesn't. But, you know, he's just like, hey, come on, let's get back to work. It's a nice little moment.
Yeah.
Interesting chapter, and I think that we're probably going to need to see really, I guess, the effects of this before we, I think, fully appreciate it, because it seems as though this is kind of a little bit of a character pivoting moment that we aren't going to actually see the full results of for a little while. Alright. Seven Deadly Sins.
Seven Deadly Sins, chapter 228, The Goddess and the Saints. Last time, the evil demon Mara Scupola, whatever her name is, went inside, basically is controlling Diana and turned her evil, has kind of just brought out her worst emotions. So she's attacking the rest of the Seven Deadly Sins in this big, angry, sort of vicious attack. And, you know, we see a couple members of the Seven Deadly Sins are trying to fight back against her. And King's sort of defending her, being like, no, you know, like, don't hurt her. You know, you, even if we, like, defeat her, it's not actually doing anything. It's not defeating the hate that's controlling her right now. So, you know, it's not effective to just fight her. So he tries to reason with her, tries to be like, no, your heart has to be stronger than that. I know you're stronger than this. But right now it doesn't help. She just, like, hicks him the fuck away. She in their evil moment is even laughing about it, like, oh dear, like, ha ha ha, I pressed your face. So Escanor, like, punches her in the stomach and, like, says the line of, out of consideration of you being a girl, I'll avoid your face. It's like, thanks for that consideration, old man. And she just fucking, like, slaps him down too. But Gowther's like, stop. But, like, you just hurt him. It doesn't help anything. I'm gonna try to help her now. So he does his invasion, his mind controlling ability to go inside of her head and tries to basically shake the control off. And she sees what Diane's mental state is right now, and she's crying because, you know, even though she got something, she knows that her actions kind of hurt Elizabeth, and she's very sad about this. And you can see Gowther's trying to kind of get through to her in this moment. She's starting to see a little bit of reason. And that's when, like, some liquidy demon that's supposed to, I think, be, you know, Mara Scupola is like, no, you don't. This is working out too well. No more. And, Gowther is unsuccessful, and Diane smashes him with her fucking hammer. And, you know, they're trying to note, like, we're not going to let you just do what you want to Diana. You're not going to be able to do as you please. And Scuba kind of fucked up. It's just like, do as I please. You mean like this? And just starts stabbing herself with her hammer. It's kind of fucked up, but.
Really, yeah. It's really troubling, honestly, to see that, because she's just, you know, Diane's already crying tears of blood, and she's got this, you know, weirdly mocking, pleasant smile on her face. She's just,
yeah. So, it's a bit, creepy of emotion there. Then Halbrum shows up. I forget what this dude even does anymore. I feel like this dude shows up every so often to die.
It's time to die again.
He dies again. I don't know what this
part is. Stupid, honestly, because, like, he dies for no reason. Like, he's like, he appears somehow before, Diane Malaskula, and, he's like, I am the one who killed you all. I am Halbrum, so I deserve to be punished. And so Dan's like, oh, hey, you're in this helmet. You killed us. You're the fairy who destroyed Cullen. Crush this helmet out. Oh, no, the spirit of Halbrum's gone. No.
I feel like this dude's died like 6 times in 7 deadly sins.
Because he turns around and he's like, goodbye, Harlequin. I'm glad I got to be your friend.
Yeah.
4 times. Yeah.
But, no, it's sad. You know, he's gone, but it didn't really change anything left. You know, they note there are a number of remaining spirits that are still not satisfied. I think maybe this was supposed to be he was somebody that suffered because of Diane's actions, and this was like, because it's her grief that's controlling her, it was supposed to be like, if he left, he would like give peace to her or something like that. Cause they note like, no, there's still a remaining spirits not satisfied from this. But regardless, she looks like she's about to do something pretty significant before this attack comes in. We hear somebody say, you can go rest and sleep now. And we see her, let there be light. And this big, light beam pierces through Diane and she regains control. And, Diane, before she kind of like, as she turns around is like, why would you do this? And we see Elizabeth and Elaine who are just like, because you're my precious friend, is that so wrong? And that is the chapter, so.
By the way, I'm fine, everybody.
Yes. But this was meant to be an important thing because we still don't know how long Elaine has left in this world and, this is supposed to be some kind of connection of.
Closing out Malaskula, so. Yes. I am right there with you with like the whole thing with Halbrum. Like, he makes this big and noble sacrifice that one doesn't really do anything. And two, seen happen at least twice before. I think at least 3 times.
I think it's been at least 3 times. Cause that was the thing in King's flashback. He came back and then was evil and had it happen then. And I think it happened one more time after that. Cause I know this has been a joke before, but like Halbrum killing himself again or dying and getting some like goodbye. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, yeah, we're going to actually close up with Black Clover this week because we have no One Piece. So, continuing the team competition, we just had, what's his name? Rill. Prove that he is the best character ever, Chris. Bullshit painting magic and stuff. He won last time. Basically single-handedly led his team to victory. And then he's like observing the aftermath of it, he's just like, oh, no, it needs to look better. We get the next one, which involves Luck and Klaus teaming up with Pooley Angel, a member of the Blue Rose Knights, who has too many buns in her hair. There are too many buns in that head.
Her head looks kind of like, yarn balls that got stuck to somebody's head.
Far too many of them. You know, like how Mineta has the grape root balls on his head? Yeah, imagine that, except they're like all his hair bound that way. So. They are going to have to go up against the wind magic user, who's said to be the most mobile member of his brigade, Rob Vitesse of the Silver Eagles, Senior Magic Knight, Second Class! And dun 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 dun. He gets this big, dramatic, like, whoosh!
And two others.
And all, the best.
And already in the ring, Chad Charleston and Joseph Powell.
And Kurt Hawkins. So, we get a little bit of a montage, kinda. Klaus and Luck going up against some of the lesser members of their opponents. Luck has these kind of lightnings surrounding his limbs as he's darting around dealing out punishments.
Well, they note that his spell shape changed, but this looks the same. I think it's just, like, aesthetically slightly different, because this is what he did before. We had, like, lightning boots and gloves. Like, that's how he used it before.
And we also get to see a little bit from Klaus, because, you know, he just has this kind of internal monologue going. He's thinking to himself, like, oh, you know, this guy's always had intermediate skills, but I see he's grown even stronger. But that's true of me as well. In imitation of Asta, I've trained my magic, my physical body, and my spirit. Even if my effort betrays me, I will not betray my effort. He watches this big frickin' steel lance drill thing in order to knock down one of their opponents. So just a brief little moment for him to shine. And that basically just leaves them up against Rob Vitesse. The other two are still up, but I mean, they just got their asses kicked, and then they just kind of stood back up, so who cares? And then we get a taste of their teammates' magic. Lee, Angel. I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to call her. Anyway, she has this thing called wing magic, and she, like, casts out this storm of wind and feathers, which she explains is, it's, you know, it attacks my enemy, but it, you know, for my allies, it's a tailwind, and she sends luck launching forward at high speed straight towards Rob Vitesse, as well as the crystal behind him. And, so, Vitesse is just like, oh, it is the differences in individual power that separate victory from defeat. And he just puts himself in between luck and the crystal. He's completely unaffected by the wind magic attacking him. And luck's just like, ah, yeah, let's do this shit. It comes in with this massive fucking kick and just kicks Vitesse into the crystal and through it. Which is pretty badass. And they win! Yay! That sets up Lux team versus Rill's team in the second round. Okay.
I hate Relnik. I don't understand him. I don't get it. He has a butler, and he has, like, a family.
Stupid?
It happened so much at once. Even a week later, and not sleep deprived, everything's just wrong. I don't get it. I know I said I wanted more about it, but not like this, Nick. Not like this! But this chapter's fine.
This chapter's fine, yeah. I was actually, like, I was really kind of dreading when Pulu got introduced, like, oh man, is she just going to be, like, another super annoying teammate that these people have to deal with? This eccentric or annoying character that's really harsh on all of them. And it's like, no. She's just like, hey, let's do this shit. And she fucking works over their teammates and they kick ass and win. It's like, okay, cool, fine.
Alright, that works. I guess it helps that, like, even though we haven't seen too many of the Blue Rose Knights, like, they usually seem pretty antagonistic, especially towards men, but she's just like, I mean, you guys are weird, but, like, let's do this shit. I'm like, I'm on board with this
works,
now.
That's the thing. She worked together with two men. Yay! All right. That's it. I know that we had to really kind of race through the recap this week, let's call it here. You have a favorite for this week, Chris?
For my favorite series, I'm going to give it to We Never Learn. I think it was a fun chapter this week. None of the other chapters really stood out as being, like, insanely, like, huge. Again, the Astralost and Space thing just didn't mean as much to me, but I liked what We Never Learned did a lot.
Mm. Astralost and Space did mean a lot to me. That's my chapter of the week. Really big, shocking reveal. I do need more details on this, but it definitely left the biggest impact on me, and I think that's what matters the most.
Character MVP I'm giving to Mimisaka, if that's his name. That's probably
cool.
Not.
Cool.
But, yeah, I liked him.
To go along with your side of thoughts, though, I'm giving it to Uruka. I thought that it was cool to see her, you know, just thinking about, like, the last half a year we've gotten from this series, when she first came around, you're just like, oh, God. Oh, no.
Yeah.
And it's really nice to see how far she's come, both, you know, in universe and just as a character.
Yeah, she definitely has been one of the more improved characters over this year.
That's it. We are done here with Weekly Manga Recap for this week. So, guys, thank you for joining us for the show. We record Weekly Manga Recap every single Wednesday, usually at about 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, although sometimes we need to change things up. And the best way to stay updated on that stuff is to follow us on social media. You can follow us at Y Roller of Time and at Roller T for your hosts and at WMR Podcast for the official podcast account. If you want to check out past episodes, you can look on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com as well as on iTunes and on our YouTube channel. If you do it on those latter two, be sure to, you know, subscribe, leave a rating, leave a comment, all that stuff. If you leave a rating on the iTunes in particular, that helps us to be the woodworking podcast and help to dominate the hobby section of iTunes, so be sure.
Yeah, we want to be the Urza of manga podcasts, so.
Loose, yeah.
We want people to eventually say, how'd they do it? Because they're WMR.
Be sure to send feedback, ask us questions, make suggestions for future manga for us to read. We'll send all that stuff to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. We are still currently working on Akunahana. I think that we might, I'm not sure how many if we can get another recommendation in before we have to just prepare for Sadistic September, because there's a 400 chapter tennis manga waiting for us, Chris.
Oh, fuck.
Yep.
Alright, yeah. I guess I prepared myself for that.
Special thanks go out to our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. As we've been alluding to in the episode we recorded, A Weekly Manga Recap Lives, the special fairy tale edition in honor of the fact that that series is ending. And that should be up very soon, right?
It's already up. If you're a bonus patron or a champion patron, you can go grab that now. By the way, special thanks to Augusto Nicholas Chicas, who is our newest patron. It is greatly appreciated. Thank you. And in case you guys are curious what this month is, we know it on the bonus pod, but for those of you who aren't already patrons, you can find out here. We're going to be trying out a new series this month. Where Nick and I are going to take a topic and, we're going to have 3 points that we're not going to tell to each other ahead of time. And we're going to reveal them to each other on the podcast as we compete head to head to see which one of us has the better opinion in a showdown. And, you know,
don't think too hard about what better opinions means.
Well, yeah. When I say opinions, I just mean because we haven't decided on the topic yet, but I threw out one to Nick before. I don't know if we'll go with that one necessarily, but, just that we will take a manga-related topic, both come up with 3 examples of it, and compete head-to-head with those thoughts, and then we'll let it to you, the audience, decide who won the showdown. So we'll give that a try this month, so if you're curious, check that out. Just make sure to be a bonus patron this month, or a champion patron during this month of August.
And finally, special thanks go out to the guys who helped make the podcast possible. We've got Infamous Planet, of course, who helped to make the frame for that you see on the video editions of the show, as well as Steve-Man, our tarot artist. You can check out his work in a number of different places, including his own Patreon, patreon.com/Steve Mann. He made the Rave Master tile card, for example, that we had last week. And he makes lots and lots of cheesecake, so be aware of that.
Yes.
That's going to do it.
Yeah, that's going to do it. Nick, you know, I had a lot of strong words for Fairy Tale at the start of this.
Yes.
And it says a lot about, I think, the upbringing I have that I already feel very guilty about a lot of those things. So I'm going to apologize if I offended anybody with my mean words about Urza. I didn't want to insult anybody or your opinions. But I am a person who suffers from a lot of guilt, and I can't stand the idea of anyone being like angry with me. So I'll take back everything I said. Fairy Tale's actually really good. It's amazing. Yeah. Urza's
Dungeon.
So delicious
and Dungeon sucks. So,
yeah, Nick doesn't care. Nick will fart all over you.
Don't give a shit.
He'll shit on your dreams and poop in your cereal. He doesn't care. But, me, no, I'm sorry if I hurt you. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.